My name is James Angus and I'm the Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences here at the University of Melbourne. On behalf of the University, it is a very great pleasure to welcome you tonight to Derek Denton Lecture in Science and the Arts. I'd particularly like to acknowledge the presence here tonight of the following people: His Excellency, the Honourable Alex Chernoff, Governor of Victoria, and Mrs. Elizabeth Chernoff, the Right Honourable Malcolm Fraser, Mr. Bailey Meyer and Mrs. Sarah Meyer, Mr. Martin Meyer and Mrs. Louise Meyer, Professor Emeritus Derek Denton and Dame Margaret Scott, Professor Emeritus Augustus Nossel, Professor Emeritus David Pennington, Professor Suzanne Corey, and the Honourable Dr. Barry Jones. The University of Melbourne acknowledges the traditional owners of the lands on which our campuses are situated. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians who have made a contribution to the life of the university community. It is now my great pleasure to introduce His Excellency, the Honourable Alex Chernoff, Governor of Victoria, who will introduce our orator.
Thank you, Dean. And I also acknowledge the distinguished guests whom the Dean named, and I hope you forgive me for not naming each and every one of you, but that will add to the brevity of the occasion if I don't do that. Like you, Dean, I join you in acknowledging the traditional owners of the land, the Kulin Nations, and pay my respects to their elders past and present. It's appropriate at this stage to acknowledge the man who was the personification of this series of lectures, Professor Derek Denton. He is, particularly in the world of science, a living legend. The university and others here and around the world regard him as one of the greatest achievers in medical science in the late 20th century. Derek Denton is renowned for his groundbreaking research work in basic biology, including vital work on the body's use of salt. Much of that work was reported in his classic book, The Hunger for Salt, which was described by Harvard University's Dr. John Pappenheimer as the best example of integrative physiology to come out of the second half of the 20th century. That quotation gives you a small taste of how highly regarded is the work of Professor Denton. He's also the founding director, or was the founding director, of the world-renowned Howard Florey Institute, and his legacy in that regard lives on through the vital work now carried on by that institute. In the international work world of science, Professor Denton's scientific and medical work have been recognised by way of many prestigious awards and appointments to leading world institutes. This includes in his early election in 1974 as a foreign medical member of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. Amongst its other duties, the Academy nominates three of the winners of Nobel Prize each year. The contribution of Derek Denton to our community is not limited to work and scholarship in science. With his wife, Dame Margaret Scott, Professor Denton has been an outstanding contributor to the arts in Australia over many years, something which was recognised in the Australia Day 2005 honours when he was made a Companion of the Order of Australia, and the citation for that award recites his outstanding leadership in medical research and the arts. And with great generosity, Professor Denton has endowed the university with funds for a continuing biennial lecture series which will bring speakers of truly global stature in science and the arts to the university and present lectures in their specialties. Importantly, Professor Denton hopes that the eminent lecturers will not only address the university community as in tonight's lecture, but also have time to engage with academics in their fields at the university. I now turn to our guest lecturer this evening, Professor Erling Norby from the Kingdom of Sweden, where, amongst other public offices, he holds the office of Lord Chamberlain in waiting in the court of King Carl Gustav XVI. He currently is serving as Vice Chairman of the J. Craig Venter Institute, which has a large research and development presence in Maryland and California in the United States. There he continues to be at the forefront of the advancement of contemporary molecular biology and provides leadership in the Institute's quest to contribute to the eradication of infectious diseases around the world. Professor Norby is one of the world's outstanding virologists and immunologists and is recognised as a leader in those fields. And if one has to highlight only one area of scientific and medical work for which the world will be forever grateful to him, it is in the area of dealing with the eradication of measles. We take it for granted today that this disease is no longer life-threatening in our country, or in the world for that matter. But only a little over a decade ago, the world saw over 45 million cases of malaria being diagnosed, from which over 800,000 people died, many in the developed world. During the past three decades or so, he produced over 400 high-level papers, about 70% of which dealt with the virus aspects of measles and its eradication. Professor Norby was instrumental in identifying the core virus and the basis for developing vaccines against that disease. And as a result of Professor Norby's work and those with whom he worked, by the end of the last decade, the number of deaths for measles in the world has been reduced to 165,000, with 77% or thereabouts being in Southeast Asia. It is a small wonder that in science and in the medical world, he's affectionately known as Mr. Measles. So tonight we have Mr. Measles and Mr. Salt. I should say that he's, of course, an expert in other infectious diseases, including HIV. As a major contributor to global research in his field, Professor Norby served for 25 years as professor and chairman at the Karolinska Institute, Sweden's leading scientific centre. Through its Nobel Committee for Physiology and Medicine, the Institute is the leading contributor to the nomination of Nobel Prize laureates in these disciplines. And from 1997 to 2003, Professor Norby was permanent secretary of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, where he expanded his continuing contribution to the Nobel Committee, this time contributing to the selection of laureates in the fields of physics and chemistry. During his near 20 years of involvement with the Nobel Prize, including a period spent as a member of the board of the Nobel Foundation, Professor Norby has had a unique insight into the working and the selection of various Nobel Prizes, including those of life sciences. The world is grateful to you, Professor Norby, for opening the otherwise mysterious world surrounding the Nobel Prize in your fabulous book, Nobel Prize in Life Sciences. We're grateful to Professor Denton for seducing you to come to Melbourne to deliver this lecture. I know that you are due to go from here to Taiwan, where you'll wear another one of your many hats, this time representing Sweden at the International Human Rights Network of the Academies and Scholarly Societies meeting. As governor and former chancellor of this university, I can say that it is a coup for the University of Melbourne and for Victoria to have you, Professor Norby, presenting what I'm sure will be a fascinating and insightful lecture this evening. I apologise in advance, Professor Norby, for leaving immediately after your lecture to attend another long-standing commitment. But ladies and gentlemen, Professor Erling Norby.
So, Your Excellency and Your Honourable Alex Chenow and Mrs. Elizabeth Chenow, I would thank you very much for that very generous introduction. It's a great joy to be here in Melbourne and to address you today. But I would also like to particularly address myself to the Dean of the Medicine, James Angus, also managing this ceremony, and foremost perhaps also to the tribute, which is to Professor Derek Denton, as you heard, a long-standing friend of Sweden. And he developed contacts way back with researchers in the field of physiology, in particular Professor Bengt Andersson, who became the professor of physiology at the Karolinska Institute in the way back in the late 1960s, successor to Ulf von Euler, one of the Nobel laureates from the Karolinska Institute. And as part of those contacts, you were selected as a foreign member of our academy, where you have been a very active foreign member, and through that you've also been selected, for example, to be a member of an OECD examining committee that came to Sweden to give advice on how we should manage our research. And as also mentioned, although that of course is something that needs to be secret, you've been active nominated for Nobel Prizes. And I might, well, reveal the secret that yes, if it hadn't been for your nomination, I think Sperry would not have gotten his prize for the split brain. But you can keep that to yourself. So, finally, I've enjoyed through the last years the fact that in your impressive, each year, little circumnavigation of the world, you make a stopover in Stockholm. Gives up time to talk about many different things, often together with Torsten Wiesel, who is a good friend of yours. And I just wish that for many years to come, you'll continue this traveling around the world so that we can meet and talk about life and the pleasures of life. Because we are privileged people, those of us who enjoy science. And I'm going to talk to you today about Nobel Prize in Nature Secret, which of course is a very wide title and allows me to really include almost whatever I like. But Nobel Prizes have a unique prestige as prizes. And you can ask, why is that? Well, first of all, they have been awarded for more than 100 years. And when the first prize were eventually given in 1901, of course, it was a particular prize. It was a large sum of money, but that turns out not to be the key thing. But it was international, and that was rare in those days of national chauvinism. And but Nobel himself, who wrote the will that really led to these prizes, he only lived in Sweden for relatively short times. He was an international businessman, so he knew what it meant to transgress borders, both in life and in science. Now, the task to select prize recipients was taken very seriously by those bodies that were selected to select them. These included the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences, which is responsible for the prize in physics and in chemistry, and the Karolinska Institute, the School of Medicine in Stockholm, that is responsible for the prize in physiology or medicine, a very clever formulation. And overall, if you read the will of Alfred Nobel, that really is the origin of these prizes, it's a very interesting document. It's written in Swedish, it's handwritten. He didn't have any legal assistance. Just took it out of his brain. And a few very, very clever aspects of the will, and that is that he said that it should be, if we not talk about the three prizes in science, it should be a matter of a discovery. And in physics, it can be a discovery or an invention. In chemistry, a discovery or an improvement. But in physiology, maybe only a discovery. So you need to define very carefully, what is a discovery? And that's been very helpful in our endeavors to really aim at these events in science that completely change the course of science. That is a true discovery. Originally, I should say also that Nobel had the idea of finding that 35-year-old who made a major discovery, giving all this money, which should be 20 years' salary. This was a scholarship, really. And he thought also that one could very quickly see when something important had happened in science, so it should be given to someone who the previous year had made this discovery. You know? And in the end, also, he was an idealist, so it should be to the benefit of mankind. Not all these dimensions could be readily fulfilled, but the committees that were set up to do this work took it very seriously. From the very first year, one secured that one had some very good nominations, very good candidates, and one made very thorough reviews of these candidates, trying to use what you might call Scandinavian objectivity and try to select the best candidate. And that has been really, the goals have been very set at this very, on this demanding level. And because of that, I would argue that more than 90% of those people that we have been selecting for the prizes have stood the test of time. And that is the reason why the Nobel Prize has become so famous. There's no other prize in the world that comes close to it when it comes to measure excellence in science. It's a historical fact. I mean, let me now describe a little things that I myself have become engaged in. And so, as was mentioned, I've been very privileged of working with a Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine for more than 20 years. So I became a professor in virology at the Karolinska Institute in 1972, and the next year, in 73, I was on that committee. Now, in formal terms, so the committee is just the five people, but medicine is such a big field that you need to really have a representation from many different disciplines. So in practice, the way we have done it for many, many years is to have a committee of five people, but to adjunct 10 people each year to assist in this. So we work with 15 people, and that's the reason why I've been both an ordinary member or an adjunct member for more than or close to 20 years and so forth. Among all the things at the Karolinska Institute, I think this interaction with the colleagues was the best, actually. We were talking about, I've been running the Karolinska Institute as a dean, and that is not an easy task, but for once in the Nobel work, one forgot about the territorial protections over, because you talked science. You tried to persuade your colleagues that the candidate you had was the most important candidate, and that the reason why they should support you in this. So you learned a lot. And someone has said that the Nobel Prizes may be more important to Sweden than to the international community. I mean, it forces the scientists in our country to keep abreast with developments and so on. So that's about the formalities. Now, what about using the material that had been accumulated over the years by the Nobel committees? So then there is a 50 years rule. Why 50 years? Well, probably the idea being that as you review the archives, the person that had been discussed should not be alive any longer. So 50 years is a long time, and you have to go back for quite a while then. So this January, I was looking then at the documents from the prize in 1961. So I started to do this a few years ago and realized that the uniqueness of this material. And that built up a number of essays that actually published in a regular scientific journal. So there is still some interesting for history. And in the end, I could bring this together into a book that's called The Nobel Prize in Life Sciences. And it stretches all the way until prizes in 1959. And it's mostly about my own field in virology, and I will come back to one of the fields here in a moment. But what is the archive material? And you can't see this in the back, but you need to see it. I just wanted to show the Nobel year. Nobel year starts more than a year before we finally give the prize, and that is we send out invitations to nominate for the prizes, because only people that are invited to nominate have the right to do that. And that is sent out way the year before, and then the critical date is January 31st, the year when the prize is going to be given, and that's the latest day for submitting a nomination. The nominations have evolved over time, and I just was at the meeting at the Academy where the physicists, for the first time, had another record, and they had 560 nominations for Nobel Prize in Physics. So you ask yourself, how do you sort that out? Well, it's a highly lubricated machinery, and of course, these are not all new nominations. They are only about some 10-15% of the new nominations. So it's an ongoing process with the reviews of that. But what other materials are there? Well, the committees work here, and they select particular candidates for reviewing. This could be shorter reviews, could be longer reviews, could be reviews of fields of science. And altogether, this builds, together with the nominations, a very interesting material. There are no discussion protocols, so you cannot see how the arguments were for and against the different candidates. You only see the conclusion of that. Sometimes you can read out that, yes, the committee could not come to an agreement. Although in my time, we mostly try to bring it so that we have a unanimous committee, but that hasn't always been the case. So someone who wants to look into this can then use this material, but it's only after permission, and it's for scholarly use. So it's not for a journalist who's curious about what happened and so forth. It is really to be used for the history of science purposes. So that is about the background material. Let me now move into some of the things I would like to share with you. First, a picture of Svengard, who was my predecessor as professor of virology at the Karolinska Institute. He became a professor there in 1948. He's been a really dominating personality in the field, called the father of virology in Sweden. And he was the one who tempted me as a medical student during the third year of my studies to shift and not becoming a clinician, but becoming a scientist. The mentor is very, very important. The reason I show Gard is also that he was very influential in Nobel work. And throughout, from 1948 and onwards until he retired in 1971, he was very active in the committee. He spoke on five occasions to the Nobel Prize recipients. Gard was interested in polio. And where did that interest come from? Well, it came from this man, whose name is Carl Kling, and he was one generation older than Gard. He had an idea that was very heretic at the time. He said, I think that polio is spreading by water. And he was even thinking about that could be some intermediate host for the virus. I mean, this was all speculative. And this was heresy because at that time, the whole idea was that polio virus can only grow in nerve cells, because Simon Flexner, who was directing the Rockefeller University or the Rockefeller Institute at that time, he had said that was so, and I'm proving it experimentally. It so happened that this is Albert Sabin, a young Albert Sabin standing on his right side, and John Paul has written the best book about polio. It's on his right side, and this is from a conference in Sweden in the early 1950s, but actually only in the microbiology. So a waterborne disease, how could that be? Well, this brings me to McFarlane Burnett. That had been one of my major engagements during the last year, because, of course, if you have started to write about Nobel Prizes, you can carry on, because there is new materials coming out every year. And the prize in 1960, as you'll see in a moment, was to McFarlane Burnett and Peter Medawar. But I wanted to highlight two things on this. To illustrate this young McFarlane Burnett with a monkey here. This is way back in the late 1920s. And a major polio epidemic had been spreading here in Montreal. And at that time, I was using antibodies, passive immunization, to protect against polio. And of course, McPhonamenet did the obvious thing. He carefully checked whether the antibodies that were generated could protect about this virus and also reference strain of virus. But it didn't block or didn't neutralize the reference strain of virus. So his conclusion was there must be more than one type of polio. It's a very important and simple discovery. And eventually, of course, it had been documented that there are three types of poliovirus. And this is absolutely essential to know if you're going to produce a vaccine that affects it. And Njål by Sanjog also explained why sometimes people could have two consequential bouts of polio. But he did something more, and that's the reason why I brought it up. And there was another epidemic in Melbourne here in the end of the 1930s. And the monkeys that were used were normally rhesus monkeys gotten from India, and they were rather difficult to infect. Someone had to really distill it into the nose of the animals. But for some reason, he couldn't get hold of that monkey. Instead, he got some cynomolgus monkeys from a more close-by setting and found out that they were more infectious than the rhesus monkeys. They could be infected straight into the throat. And then Burnett did one of the simple experiments that can reflect his really genius. So he simply took two monkeys, and instead of exposing the upper respiratory tract and so forth, he injected the virus directly into the intestine. And what happened? The animals got polio. So that showed that, yes, polio is transmitted as an enteric infection, the virus goes to the intestine, and that's why the infection starts. And that was a completely new perspective on polio. But Burnett did so many different things so that these particular discoveries were never highlighted in particular. Anyhow, in the early part of the 20th century, polio was the number one scare when it came to diseases. And the contribution by these three men was absolutely seminal in changing that. It was an example of a very serendipitous finding. What had happened? Well, the three people are Thomas Weller, Frederick Robbins, and John Enders, and they're working in John Enders' laboratory. And John Enders, he was interested in trying to make viruses causing disease in man growing in cell cultures, because that was the way of studying the viruses. And then it happened that Thomas Weller, he had received material from a legally aborted human fetus. He had some cell cultures. He wanted to see if varicella virus could grow in this. So he put varicella virus on that. They had some leftover cultures. And for some reason, the history is not very clear, one took some polio material from the freezers and put that on the cells. And of course, varicella virus didn't grow, but polio virus grew directly. And this shouldn't be, because Simon Flexner said they can only grow in nerve cells. It wasn't true. It could grow in any kind of cells, in fibroblasts, endothelial cells, and so forth. And this opened up a completely new field, because if you could grow poliovirus in this kind of cell, you could also produce a vaccine. And very rapidly, one initiated program to develop a vaccine. Now, a guard, of course, introduced this laureate at the prize ceremony, and he highlighted it was not only that they had managed to grow poliovirus in cells, it had a more general importance, namely that there were now techniques to identify many different viruses by the new kind of procedure, and that was by using trypsin, you could get a monolayer culture of cells. You could now study viruses in a way that you could never do before. And that's why God says that by giving the virologist a practicable method for the isolation and study of viruses, you relieve them of a handicap, burdening them since from the birth of their science, and place them for the first time on even footing with other microbe hunters. The golden era of virology had been opened up, as highlighted by Burnett. But Burnett also was a kind of end of science person. He said, so during the 50s, we isolated all these medically important viruses, which was great. But coming to the end of that decade, many of the important viruses have been isolated. So according to Burnett, that was the time to shift to another field that I will come to in a moment. And of course, that was when I started in virology in 1959. So, but there were a few more things to do, actually. Now, you could ask yourself, why didn't one wait for the polio vaccine? Because according to Nobel, it should for the benefit of mankind. And wouldn't it be nice to have that application in it? Well, so Jonas Salk was the one who very rapidly developed the inactivated vaccine. And then a few years later, Sabin introduces live vaccine. But that wasn't registered until and started for use in 1961, whereas the inactivated vaccine was available for use in 1955. So there were many nominations for Salk. But Svengard and Salk had an argument. Salk said that the inactivation of poliovirus is a first-order kinetics, and one used formalin for that. Svengard said, it's not. It's much more complicated than that, because formalin can hit on both the genetic material of the virus and on its protein coat. And depending on that, you can have different kinetics. So what does Gard say here? He says, according to my opinion, Salk has not demonstrated the caution that one would expect to be applied in this context. What had happened was that some of the early vaccines had led to polio in those that were vaccinated because the virus was not fully inactivated. And Gard did not accept that. He said, that is not the ethics we want to have. And it is my view, based on these conclusions, that Salk's publication on the poliomyelitis vaccine cannot be considered priceworthy. That's a term that we use. It's not priceworthy. And if Svengard had said that, of course, Salk would never get a prize, and he never did. So this is the polio thing. But let me show what is developing right now in the field of polio vaccination. And here we talk about the use of the live vaccine. So the World Health Organization decided that they wanted to eradicate polio in 1988. And they started a broad vaccination program. And you can see quite a success story. Originally, 125 countries had the disease with ongoing infections, so-called endemic disease, and came all the way down to four here. Originally, one had hoped that this would come to an end of the year 2000. It did not. Turned out to be a number of complications. And we're still struggling with those complications. I won't dwell on that by simply showing, yes, we have three countries still that have endemic polio. It's, of course, Pakistan and Afghanistan and Nigeria. And here there are problems with infrastructure, and one is really putting a pressure on this, because there are just the three countries remaining. If one could bring that to conclusion, one should eradicate polio. Still some optimists. I think that we could do it at the end of this year. One thing that's encouraging is that just in the last 2 years, the whole of India has become polio-free. For a long time, India has remained with polio. So that's about eradication of this disease. In fact, poliovirus type 2 has been eradicated. This 1 and 3 that we are struggling with right now. And the inspiration to eradicate polio, of course, came from the success of eradicating smallpox. And this is a fantastic story of organization. And I would like to point out one of my heroes here, Frank Fenner, a most fantastic colleague and a very, very qualified virologist and an inspirator. And he was the chairman of the committee that declared that smallpox had been eradicated from the world, which is a fantastic achievement. You could ask, so why don't give a Nobel Prize for that achievement? That's indeed to the benefit of mankind, because there were millions and millions of people dying in smallpox. Now, so we have a rule at the Karolinska Institute and at the Academy too, we do not give prizes to institutions, we give it to individuals. Maximum 3 individuals. And in this case, it was, the World Health Organization, it was that. So my suggestion would be, why couldn't one give a peace prize for such a contribution? Could be an interesting way of solving this dilemma that we can't give it to institutions. Now, so one can even show this is the last case of smallpox that happened in our world, and we don't need to vaccinate any longer. I won't go into the other aspect of that. But I'm very, very glad that Mr. Governor mentioned measles, because that was my first love in virology, and that's what I wanted to bring this picture in here. And it is true that in a quiet way, I mean, the World Health Organization had decided we need to do something about measles, because for many years there was 1 million children dying in measles from a readily preventable disease, because they have a good vaccine. And the outcome of this is that from the year 2000 to 2010, there is a reduction to this number of 139,000 cases, 74% reduction. One had aimed actually for a 90% reduction, but didn't reach that. And there are a number of other complications. But you can see in the Americas and in Europe, yes, one has really come a long way. Now, if the World Health Organization had decided to eradicate measles instead of polio, I'm sure that one would have concluded that by now, because it is much easier to eradicate measles than to eradicate polio. But there are ambitions forward. The plans are now from the 2012 to 2015 to come down to the 90% level. And in the year 2020, the goal is to have eradicated measles in 5 out of the 6 regions. So that's really a good hope for the future. There is another disease that has been eradicated that very few people know about. And that is the disease Rinderpest that occurs in cattle. And Rinderpest is a very close relation to measles. In fact, it's probable that measles, which is this acute disease in humans, came from Rinderpest and adapted to human beings. Because these acute infections, they are community dependent. And human civilization didn't have large enough populations until about 3,000 years ago, where one could sustain acute infection. I think most of you will be surprised to hear that more 5,000 years ago, there were no common cold, there were no measles, mumps, rubella, what have you. They have all developed at a later stage because they're community dependent. Now, anyhow, so this gentleman here, Walter Plowright, some very pioneering work. And it, one can now conclude that, and I think it's about 2008, that one declared the world free of Rinderpest. So the vaccine had really served its purpose and need not be used any longer. So that's about eradication of diseases. And let me come back to Burnett and then to the case of his polio, his Nobel Prize. So Sven Gard was struggling with the nomination for Burnett, because being the tall figure that he was nominated from 1948 and onwards, over and over again. And Sven Gard was reviewing all this, and each time there was reviewed all this fantastic work, with emphasis on receptors, and then all these are contributions that are prize-worthy. And so we were declared prize-worthy. But the question is, which discovery should one select? I mean, and I think Gard properly selected this discovery that the influenza virus has receptors. If you block these receptors, you can block the disease. Makes a lot of sense. But that never came about. And year after year, and in 1957, when Burnett became a foreign member of our academy, said, okay, I guess that instead of the Nobel Prize then. Yeah. So, and this is what happened in the Nobel work. It comes up like this, and if it doesn't carry, then in the end, of course, the interest is coming down. So here was the problem. Here was the person who really should have the Nobel Prize. But one couldn't sort that out within his contributions in virology. So what happened? He instead got a prize in immunology. And just by way of background, I wanted to illustrate to you this. Immunology is very well represented among Nobel Prizes. And these were the five prizes in immunology prior to 1960. But there hadn't been anyone since 1930, so it was quite a long time span here. Now, The reason this came about is an example of how a committee tried to really resolve a very complicated issue. In 1958, there was a nomination for Medawar and his collaborators for their demonstration that one could induce tolerance. And the story about that, to give you that in a summarized way, Peter Medawar is really on this little, I would say, in the same category like Burnett when it comes to mind and character. He's one of the giants in science, one of the fantastic, brilliant intellects. And he became interested during the Second World War about the possibility of transplanting skin. And in those days, one really didn't have an idea, why can't you take skin from one person and put it to another person? And he reviewed that, found the basic techniques that there were, could show that, yes, an inflammation process going on at a time of rejecting a tissue, that if you gave the same tissue twice, it would reject it faster the first time than the second, pointing towards that this is probably an immunological reaction. But no one really knew what the case was at that time. And also one could find that, yes, you could transplant skin within the individual from one part of the body to the other, but not between individuals, unless if they were identical twins. So Medawar was in Stockholm and he met a veterinary pathologist there who was a little intrigued by the fact that he had problems in distinguishing identical and non-identical twins in calves. And so we asked Medawar, what could I do about that? And of course, Medawar said a little cocky, oh, it's simple. I mean, you just take some tissue and you transplant that from one to the other. If it's rejected, they are non-identical. If it stays, they are identical. Very simple. So they did the experiment and it failed. So why was that? Then they realized, and that was the first time that Medawar encountered that. There had been studies a few years earlier by someone called Owen, who had shown that there's something special about twins in calves, and they share their placenta. So therefore, this is a natural situation that even if you have non-identical twins, there's induction of tolerance, a mutual induction of tolerance. And Burnett, okay, so who was well read on this, and he had been reflecting on problems like that, self and non-self. How does the body distinguish between that it doesn't react with an immune system to its own cells, but it reacts to foreign infectious agents and other things. And Burnett's thinking is really very, very crystal clear. And he simply said the following, and this comes in a book together with Frank Fenner in 1949. And what does he say? He says, if in embryonic life, expandable cells from a genetically distinct race are implanted and established, no antibody response should be developed against the foreign cell antigen when the animal takes on an independent existence. You can notice it's brilliant language also. This two sentences is the basis for Burnett's Nobel Prize. That's no experiment, nothing. He tried to confirm it, he failed. But Medawar and his people, that is, together with Billingham and Brent, they did the experiments. So they used inbred mice, and they simply took out cells from one strain of mice, injected that into the embryo at that various stage of development, and could show that, yes, tolerance was induced. And it was simple to illustrate, because if you look at this mice, you could now take a skin from the black mice, the cells from which had been used to try to induce this tolerance, and it could grow, and there was no immunological reaction. So very clean, simple experiment, and that was the basis for this Nobel Prize. Now, the first nomination for a prize to Medawar came in 1958. And was reviewed by a colleague of Sven Gard, actually next door neighbor, also professor of bacteriology, Malmgren. And he reviewed this very carefully and said, no, this is worth it. This is the best since Ehrlich and these early prizes in immunology. But we cannot give a prize to Medawar without recognizing that, in fact, Burnett had already postulated this in his book from 1949. So that rested. 2 years later, again, nomination for induced tolerance. But in none of those nominations is there a nomination for joining Medawar and Burnett. No, that is constructed by the committee. So there is a nomination for Medawar, of course, for his work, and Svengard evaluates that and he makes very clear, yes, this is a fantastic achievement. And then there is another nomination for Burnett for his contribution to immunology, but not for induced tolerance, but for this clonal selection theory, because he had published this book in 1959 that was really breaking up immunology and opening up new vistas on that. And then there's a nomination by Josh Lederberg, which may interest you guys, because he nominates, Medawar for induced tolerance. He discusses Burnett, and he thinks that Burnett should probably get it for the influenza work. That is major contribution. And but he mentions also that, well, he has made some contribution in immunology, but then he thinks about the clonal selection theory. So Burnett was never nominated for his theoretical contribution to induced tolerance. So, anyhow, so Svengard and the committee, they tried to focus on this, and therefore it came up with a joint nomination of the two. The committee was not unanimous this year. The majority, they wanted to have John Eccles, another Australian, together with Magoon. That was the majority, including the chairman, Ulf von Euler, and there were 5 members of the committee that know which be given to Burnett and Medawar. And that, Sven was very proud. I managed, in the meeting with the faculty of college, to take the final decision to turn them around. So Eccles had to wait for some time before he could get his prize. But an interesting, really, background to all this. And here are the two Nobel laureates. I mean, I tell you, it's very, very encouraging to write about their life contributions and how they follow up on this. Of course, Burnett, and he said, well, so I got it in immunology, but for the second best thing I did in immunology. What was the best thing? Well, the best thing was, of course, the clonal selection theory. I mean, this is something that's so fundamental. And so Nils Jerne had found that sometimes you find antibodies to antigens that have never seen the animal before, like phages and so forth. And he developed that in the mid-1950s, but it was Burnett who really said, I think it works on the level of clones. And then again, the common nominator is there must be receptors here. So how does it work? It works by, in the body, there is an amazing generation of an immune response to essentially any kind of antigen. And then when foreign antigen gets in, it selects a particular clone that has the best fitness, and then the cells start to divide. And that's how you could generate a clonal response, and that's how nature works. Nature is very wasteful. I mean, if those antibodies that we produce using this fantastic repertoire represent probably less than a per mil or something like that. Most of it is just there to safeguard the system. So, and in 1984, Nils Jerne got his Nobel Prize as a part of a prize that I'll show in a moment. And then Burnett sent him a telegram, of course, to say, I think that you and I should have shared that prize, but we are both Nobel laureates, so what does it matter? Now, I will brief in my presentation quite extensively here and just say, so immunology has been very well covered by prizes. Of course, what we call innate immunity or non-adaptive immunity, as was recognized in 1908, but again, first 100 years later by the Price to Beutler and Hoffman. Immunology has to do with antibodies. I would argue has also been very, very well covered, and I don't want to recapitulate, but we have given price to the structure of antibodies, to sensitive assays, to some of the genetics for production of antibodies, to the hybridoma technology, and to the technique by which our body can generate antibodies to essentially any antigen that there exists. What about cell-mediated immunity? The fact that there were different branches of immunology started to emerge way back in the 1940s by Landsteiner. So there were some forms of immunity that could not be transmitted by antibodies, had to be transmitted by cells, or cell-mediated immunity. And this I could elaborate on quite extensively on, but I won't do that because of time. I would argue that in this list of prizes here, which actually include the dendritic cells in 2011, this list is incomplete. The fundamentals of distinguishing B and T cells, I think they were named by Ivan Roth eventually, but there were people that discovered that thymus is not a vestigial organ. It's the organ that is responsible for developing the maturation of T cells. And for the distinction of different kind of T cells, also at fundamentals. And in addition, James Gowen's work on circulation of the cells through the lymphatic system, those are very, very fundamental. In an essay, Medawar has written about analytic and synthetic discoveries. And then he lists examples of what are synthetic discoveries. Well, one is circulation of lymphocytes by Gowans. One is identical T cells, and he mentioned both Jacques Miller and Bob Good. And he also mentioned one third kind of synthetic discovery to exemplify his case. So I wanted to show this picture, the man who did discover the T cells in 1961. And who has written this review 50 years later on this discovery. Australian Nobel laureates. I think this country should be rather proud of its series of Nobel laureates, but this, you see, I put a little more reddish color on some of them. Macfarlane Burnet, simply, he stayed with his home country and he developed in a fantastic way the field here. Eccles came a few years later. You have in literature, and then Peter Doherty together with Zinckernagel. It's very highly motivated prize in the field of cell-mediated immunity, but kind of should have been preceded by some other prizes. And of course, Warren and Marshall also a beautiful pioneering work that there is. And I would like to finish with something that I call John Eccles' experience of uncooling champagne. And they simply, so in 1960, 7 of the 12 members voted for Eccles together with the chairman. And that he should receive the prize together with Horace Magoon, but 5 voted for Burnet and Medawar, who got the prize, right? Fortunately, in a way, it was good that Magoon was never recognized because later on he didn't come to the measure. But next year, one had worked further on the Eccles candidacy, which was, of course was very strong. And 7 of the 12 members, again, they voted for Eccles together now with Alan Hodgkin and Andrew Huxley, but 5 voted for George von Beckese, who eventually selected by the faculty. So again, had to take the champagne out of the fridge and put it back next year. But next year was the DNA year. So, and that's another long story that I won't dwell on. But the prize was given to Crick, Watson, and Wilkins. And in 1963, Eccles finally did receive his prize. So. And with this kind of progress that we have here from year to year, you can imagine that I will be kept busy as long as I have health to do this, because and then I can start to write about Actually, I have written about Bekesi already, and I have some six chapters for a coming book. And I thought I would add the 1962 story, which of course is its own right. But then from there on, you can write on neurophysiology, a lot in molecular biology. 1960s is a very exciting time in the Nobel Prizes, very, very high quality prizes. And yeah, this is all very, very great learning experience. And I know that time is flying, so I would like to just express my thanks to you for this, your patience, and to you, Derek, and I know it's been a joy to honor you by this little presentation, and I look forward to all the coming contacts. Thank you so much.
Well, Professor Norby, what a feast. Looking backwards at these great names, it rings bells in the mind. I tried to tot up how many Nobel Prize winners I'd been taught by, and I can count at least 10, and I won't go through the experience of all of them, but it really is a noble award, and long may it live. I'd like to just make one or two thoughts that I might share with you. We're going to have dinner this evening in University House. And 4 years ago, I was having coffee in the afternoon in University House. And in walked a lady who I hadn't seen since I'd worked with her in Nairobi in the 1970s, Professor Matai, the only woman from Africa to get a Nobel Prize, a Nobel Peace Prize. And I was so thrilled to see her. And I said, Professor Matai, do you remember the time that we were together in those veterinary laboratories that you referred to in your talk? And she said, yes, I do. And I said, tell me, I don't know about your Nobel Prize. Can you just explain it to me? And she said, yes, I was given the Nobel Peace Prize for succeeding in getting the women of rural Kenya to plant 40 million trees. Wow. Last year, Professor Matai died, but not before I'd given her a piece of paper, which I'm going to give to you as well. I have a sin, which is collecting antique books. And I bought this lovely book, which I've got a photocopy of, called A Treatise of the Laws of the Forest, which was published in England and written by a man called John Manwood. And that was in 1615. But the book begins with the Carta de Forestia of King Canutus, a Dane, King of England, in 1016 AD, where he laid down the forest laws for England, and these were subsequently adopted by his other kingdoms of Denmark and Norway. But what an amazing document. And the governor would be fascinated by it with his legal background, because it's now regarded as probably the original forest laws which determine where all Australia's forests belong. They are a property of the crown, thanks to King Canute. So King Canute's Forest Laws, 1016, give or take 4 years, that's 1,000 years ago. Could you take this back with you?
With pleasure.
And see if you could think how we could celebrate the planting of all those trees and get it done not just in Kenya, but all over the world. Because this morning, looking at my emails, I see the Director General of the World Wildlife Fund this very morning has announced that 13 million hectares of forest have been lost each year between 2000 and 2010. Canute told us how to save the world's forests. Surely we can do that again. Well, I would like to give you a farewell present from the university that will celebrate your visit here and hopefully remind you of the happy times and the new faces that you've met. And I've been thrilled to meet you and to chat too often. But if I may just get the presents. I know these are always difficult things to carry in your baggage, but here is a memorial to the Derek Denton lecture, which we would like to give to you, and the university crest on a lovely little medallion inscribed to you. So I think we should give a loud round of applause to you for that wonderful lecture, and please come again.